So this is Mae Brussel. This is KAZU FM in Pacific Grove, California. It's broadcast number 648, and it's May the 7th, 1984. Reverse those numbers around. It is May the 7th, 1984. And we'll begin the program by mentioning, this is the third week I've mentioned it, that stamp, the National Archives, that I said the quotation came from The Tempest. What is past is prologue. That was Shakespeare. And then I bought a book this past week at a book sale, and I opened it up. It's about the far right wing in America and the Communist Party. And there was a foreword by William Noland in the book, and the foreword begins, "On the National Archives building in the nation's capital is etched the inscription, 'What is past is prologue.'" That's why the stamp has it 50 years on the anniversary of the National Archives, but what is etched up there was William Shakespeare in The Tempest, and don't forget it, because it surely will happen again. What has happened before will happen again. Last year, just at this time, broadcast number 596, May the 9th, 1983, I was talking about W.R. Grace, who acquired a DeLorean subsidiary, helping him out financially in Troy, Michigan, the John Kennedy assassination, and the link of Henry Kissinger and George Bundy and the Harvard team working with the National Security Council, waiting safely for, in quotes, the duration of Kennedy's administration before Kissinger and Nixon could get back to power. The word duration with quotes was from the book The Portrait of a Mind of Henry Kissinger by Stephen Graubard, published by W.W. Norton. And then I was talking about last year the Hitler's Diary in the role of U. Trevor Roper, who wrote the introduction to Mark Lane's book, Rush to Judgment, and U. Trevor Roper identifying the Hitler Diary and going into certain people that were very strong with Adolf Hitler back in the bunker, the Battle of the Bulge, where we have our Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger, Wilhelm Mumke, SS Karl Wolf, the hardline Nazis, and then these names surface up again, not only in the Battle of the Bulge, but at the Hitler bunker, then working with the last years of the war with Alan Dulles and William Donovan, making ready for teamwork when the war was over, and having a role in the Hitler Diaries that surfaced just a year ago. Briefly, I just want to say that May the 7th, 1960, that was a while ago on the same date as this evening, the Soviets disclosed the capture of the U-2 plane, and CIA pilot Gary Powers was down, and the State Department said it was a weather flight that was not authorized. Remember the U-2 flight? That happened May the 7th, 1960. Gary Powers, the pilot, said that Lee Harvey Oswald had the capability or hinted that he was able to down the flight, and Oswald was stationed at two U-2 bases, one in the Philippines and one in Japan. He was also at Taiwan, then went to that mysterious radio factory in Minsk, and that broke up the peace summit that Eisenhower wanted. He wanted to be known, or said he wanted to be known, as a man of peace. And his meeting with Khrushchev was to take place a few weeks later. It was canceled. And then that's when the Defense Department really came in and made the decisions for the President of the United States. And then John Kennedy was murdered, and the Cold War escalated into a hot war, and then escalated the Vietnam scene. But that 1960, Lee Harvey Oswald was in the Soviet Union at the Minsk radio factory and allegedly had the capability through his training in Marines, intelligence, and so forth to be able to down that plane and help the Navy intelligence and the Pentagon to break up the chance of a peace conference. Most of this evening I'm going to talk about a very important subject, the Sinfuel scandal. Because Sinfuel, synthetic fuel, is what Adolf Hitler was making at Auschwitz with IG Farben to become energy independent during World War II, not needing to import oil. And in Washington, there is a Sinfuel scandal that's been going on and bubbling in the news. And I came to it quite early through the back door, studying Edwin Meese's control of the news media in Grenada, and came upon a foundation in San Francisco that was set up for Edwin Meese to control the news out of the White House. And this was a test case of never having any American news people with an invasion or military action of any kind in Grenada. So the bulk of the program this evening is going to be on the convoluted web of the Sin Fuel controversy and Edwin Meese and Ronald Reagan. But before I begin that, there is something I want to share with you. There's some things that I like or love very much. One was the rock music scene, the Monterey Pop, and the various artists and musicians that one by one were wiped out and neutralized, and I believe were death squads taking care of them. It seems that in the theater, this is same thing is happening, and it isn't so visible or obvious as it wasn't when Janis Joplin died, or Mama Cass, or Otis Redding, or Jim Croce. Those numbers, like 30 or 40, add up to you, and I think about Mr. Fassbinder, or the German director who died last year, and Mr. Taylor, who wrote the play Good. And I just wanted to update you on a few stories on this subject and a couple of deaths that I haven't shared with you, and one that I feel really badly about that happened this week. An actress and singer from Argentina, her name is Nasha Guevara, was living in Argentina. In 1974, she was given 48 hours to get out of Argentina. And they said, "You will be murdered." The right-wing extremist death squad said, "You will be murdered if you don't get out." And they targeted 100 artists of the country, cultural contributors to Argentina. And she was one of 100 people that were ordered to leave immediately. And there's an article about it in the New York Times not too long ago, and she said that she wasn't political. You hear this all the time. She didn't think about politics. "I never belonged to a political party. I think I have another duty in my life as an artist, but I was involved in my country, and we have to learn to live together without killing one another." So when she was ordered to get out, she left with her husband, and she went to various countries, to Peru and Spain, Mexico City. And while she was in Europe, she met a well-known director, Harold Prince, who asked her to be in Evita in London. She didn't like the story that they did, the particular story of Evita Perón, and she didn't want to be in it. But she met Harold Prince, and he arranged for her to have a concert in New York City, and she came over there in 1983, last year, to New York City. And she did audition for Evita, but didn't want it. And Harold Prince helped her come to America, and she gave a concert at the St. James Theater in 1979 and came back in 1983 and was at a nightclub. And the important thing about this woman was that she didn't think of herself political, but the death squads were escalating. She said it was a time of horror. People were killing each other. She couldn't believe it was true. It seemed so crazy. And she went back in 1975, and at the theater, a bomb was planted, and two people were killed. And she said it was the real beginning of the terror age. Now, last week and for the last few weeks, I've been talking at length about Robert Keith Gray, the public relations executive who opened his offices in Washington in 1981 and made a hunk of $1 million in just 2 years up till 1983, and represents countries like Turkey and Haiti. And he just took his vice president of Gray & Company, Mr. Alejandro Orfila, O-R-F-I-A-L-A, the former head of the Organization of American States. Orfila represented the Argentine government in the United States for 25 years while all the death squads were going on in Argentina and elsewhere in South America, Bolivia, and around the world, but particularly down in South America with the Nazis escalating those in the last 10, 15 years. And Orfila is now part of the Robert Gray office, but he was part of the Argentina that forced 100 artists like this to leave the country. Now, one of the people, she's alive, but one of the people that concerns me who was murdered, just this was May 21st, 1983, just a year ago this week, or next week, Philip Fradkin. He was 61 years old. He was leaving the theater, his musical director of 42nd Street, the play, the Broadway musical. He was struck and killed by a hit-and-run car. He was trying to get a cab on 11th and 57th Street in New York. He was killed. He was the musical director of Gypsy. The music for that was written by Stephen Sondheim and starred Angela Lansbury. And he was the musical director of Timbuktu, starring Eartha Kitt, who also was political in a way, and so is Stephen Sondheim. And he was thrown in the air and dead on impact. Another terrible loss, May 17th. This came just 2 weeks, or 4 days rather, before the one murder by the car of Philip Fradkin. Mark Syers, S-Y-E-R-S, an actor who did appear in Evita and other musicals. He had the leading role of the Spanish singer, the tango singer, Mr. Magaldi. And I have the tape cassette in the car and the records. I listen over and over again. He opened with Evita in New York and was on the road tour then in L.A. that went back to New York. He was in New Jersey. He was hit by a car that collided with him, and he was dead immediately with a crushed head. He also was in Godspell and Jesus Christ Superstar, but he had the lead song in Pacific Overture, the song Someone in the Tree. And if any of you read the story of Stephen Sondheim, again, the one who wrote Gypsy, who wrote Pacific Overtures, and Freddie Prinze, again, directed the Evita show as in London as well as New York, this Mr. Syers sang Someone in the Tree. Now, just 2 years ago this month, I did a broadcast. I was at KLRB those days and played for the last 5 minutes of the broadcast the song Someone in the Tree. Sondheim says it's his favorite song. He always talks about it. It's a very powerful song. It is a statement about the world and politics and selling people out, selling nations out, and how a person hears the deal by which we are literally undermined by our own members who betray us, in that case, Japanese, selling out to American interests and American businesses. So he was hit by a car, had his head smashed, and Mr. Syers, who does that song, and it's on all the records, is the singer in Evita and also Pacific Overtures, had his head smashed. And the reason I bring those up is that this week, Alan Schneider was in London producing a new play called The War at Home by James Duff. We'll have to see what that play is about. Alan Schneider was hit by a motorcycle. The New York Times said there were no charges filed. The motorcyclist didn't require medical attention. Alan Schneider died. He probably was the best director, for my taste, not yours maybe, on the American theater. He brought Samuel Beckett to this country. He did the Albee plays, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. He directed Waiting for Godot. That and Endgame are my two absolute favorite plays. And Delicate Balance. He brought every avant-garde thing that was decent, that had a statement, in Mr. Pinter's Dumbwaiter, The Collection, The Birthday Party. He directed all of these. He directed Anastasia. And he was close to Samuel Beckett. He has two shows of Beckett's on Off-Broadway now. He's done Thornton Wilder's Our Town, but he's known for his avant-garde things like Crap's Last Tape, Happy Days, and Endgame, directing all of these plays, and close to those thinkers. Now, Beckett is one of my heroes. He fought in the underground with the Free French, with Sartre, fighting Hitler and Nazism, and these plays, I just think they're great. The Ballad of the Sad Cafe, Tiny Alice, The Delicate Balance. He brought all of those plays off Broadway, on Broadway, and he was one of the most important American directors of contemporary theater. To talk about his death being killed like these other people, with somebody just going into him and splattering their brains around, is as horrendous as talking about Jimi Hendrix or Janis Joplin. I love the theater, and I like the music scene, too, and this really hurts. And when I see people, the common denominator here is Harold Prince and Stephen Prince and Stephen Sondheim and the avant-garde theater, the people that are saying something, not the old reruns, not the old tired plays that may be good, but have no guts or feeling. These are the plays that have given my life meaning. And there was an interview about Alan Schneider talking about Beckett. And he once said about Beckett, he says, it's Samuel Beckett more than anyone else who has taught me that in spite of anything or whatever, one goes on, not distracted or disturbed, whether you have success or failure, whether you surface and do well or whether you go under, whether you're criticized or praised or even your own self-criticism, you live and you go on to live. And that's what Endgame and Godot are about. And he says he learned that from Beckett. And I learned my philosophy of life from these playwrights that he directed and brought here. He was fresh. He was new. And when this lady says that 100 of them were told to get out of Argentina or they'd be dead in 48 hours, and when you think the ambassador from Argentina now works with William, and all these years, 25 years with Paul Axalt and William Casey and Robert Keith Gray, from Task Force 157 with Kissinger and Edwin Wilson and that can of worms, Argentina and Chile are coming to the United States and London. I know they are, and they follow these people, and they're not going to let you have these things to live by. In order to fight fascism or to have a better life, you have to have something to live by. And I personally found a tremendous amount of strength through tribulations that I've had, when I'm happy, when I'm sad, when I'm philosophical, whether I'm relaxing or political. Every play that really had any meaning to me, he brought to this country and was the first director of those plays. And it really made me, as I say, very, very sad to know how these people, these records that we have of Pacific Overture or Evita, that these guys all had the same death with the brain spread out and the same friends in common, the same common denominators, and that somebody has targeted these people. I'm convinced that this isn't just a coincidence, and there are even more, and you can add them up, and I'll do that eventually like I did with the rock musicians, and you can see what's happening to the culture of this country. In the meantime, they give you Culture Club, which is okay. I don't mind it. I think Culture Club is kind of funny, but it's not culture. And boy, George is cute and he's amusing, but that's not Waiting for Godot or Endgame, and there's no substitute for something really great. There have been reviews of Endgame compared by Herbert Blau, the Actors' Workshop, that it's the greatest tragedy since Shakespeare's Macbeth, that Hamlet. It's in that category, Godot, and a man like this doesn't deserve that. Now we'll see what his play was in London that opens up, just like Mr. Taylor, who wrote Good, and 3 weeks or four after the play opens in London, he again has an accident and dies, the same kind of a death over there. Some in New York, some in New Jersey, and some in London, but they're all dying the same way, and we're deprived of anything they're going to do in the future. Now I'm going into the synthetic fuel scandal because I'm doing a continuous series on Edwin Meese and Ronald Reagan and the Reagan administration. The synthetic fuel scandal is the story of unlimited money. And I'll give you a breakdown on it because I can't do it all in one evening. It'll probably be a two-part series. It is the story of literally unlimited money, excessive secrecy, dangerous genetic cancer-causing birth defects that the waste product is proven to be making, no provisions to clean it up or account to any single person as against the Environmental Protection Agency. Past presidents, like Jimmy Carter, set up the Synthetic Fuel Organization that has escalated with Ronald Reagan, and the men in charge of the Synthetic Fuel Corporation. It's called the Synthetic Fuel Corporation. It isn't a corporation. It's a United States government taxpayers' money. You would think it was a private business if you read Wall Street Journal or New York Times or various books on it. It's Synthetic Fuels Corporation. It's nothing like that at all. It's all American tax dollars. The former last two presidents of the government offices of the Synthetic Fuel have been forced to leave because of irregularities and legal technicalities translated some more sleazy operations of Ronald Reagan's. One of them that just recently stepped down has a missing $20 million loan from his bank in Oklahoma, and he didn't tell the people when he was being interviewed for this job or the board of directors of the bank about the $20 million missing. That's about a little less than half of what Michael Sindona is in jail for 45 years in New York. The taxpayers pay for it, and they give money to corporations like Dow Chemical and Texaco and Union Oil and Exxon for exploration that they don't want to put up themselves, but we should put it up for them, and then they can ask any price they want. It's been described as cronyism at its worst. It involves Ronald Reagan's closest associate, Edwin Meese, and Reagan close to the head of the Synfuel organization, and I'll go into the details of these seedy characters one by one. Now, the brief chronology of the way the story broke, I'm not going to give you all the items, but just a few of them. April the 4th, the San Francisco Chronicle, and this was in other papers around the country, but some stories were larger than others, Syn Fuel Agency chief should resign. They're referring to a Victor M. Thompson, Jr., the head of a Tulsa bank in Oklahoma, who did, in fact, resign. But on April the 4th, they said he should resign as president of the United States Synthetic Corporation because he's either incompetent or he's unethically suited for the job. The salary is $135,000 a year. Outside of Ronald Reagan, it's the highest paid salary in the United States for anybody. April the 12th, the following week, San Francisco Examiner, Senator Proxmire charges the Synthetic Fuels Corporation with excessive secrecy. He said they have inflated salaries, excessive secrecy, little concern for the taxpayers, they're wasting millions, and they should be stopped. Congress is recently giving them $15 billion from Congress, and they're too concerned with secrecy. Now, synthetic fuels were made by Adolf Hitler at Auschwitz for IG Farben. The technology for making this fuel has been available for a long time. So the excess of secrecy is probably to hide what they do with the money and who they pass it on. The following week, April the 10th, a large story, $4.4 billion for the Syn Fuel project was given by the government, the subsidies, for six large energy projects. They were asking for the resignation of the president, so before he resigns, he allocates $4.4 billion the day after they call for his resignation of Mr. Thompson, and Congress is trying to block this money, and Representative Howard Wolpe of Michigan said that it should be blocked. And of that money, besides Union Oil, is $620 million to Dow Chemical, and we'll go into that. That's owned by Chevron, and makers of paraquat and other dangerous poisons, and they allocated that money to them. There's an editorial in the Washington Post, Sunday, April 22nd, Reagan's Youth Synthetic Fuels Corporation, like the Environmental Protection Agency, like the Consumer Product Safety Commission, has no interest in their agency's work or in the qualifications of the people who work for them. This is an editorial blasting the inconsiderate attitude of the people from that organization and how they literally don't give a damn about anybody. That's what the editorial was about. The Washington Post had another story 5 days later on the 27th of April. Big Syn Fuels project gets U.S. backing. Before, in the same day as when Mr. Thompson decided to resign, he gave $790 million for a North Dakota project that was very controversial. The Department of Energy had given them $2.1 billion loan guarantee. And they said, well, we won't finish our job now unless you give us more. And he saw Mr. Thompson before he quit the job. He was on the board of directors and the president of the group. He allocated $790 million. But Edwin Meese had called the chairman, Mr. Edward Noble, and we're going to him in a minute, to the White House and wanted the money given to this project. It was important to Edwin Meese that the money go to North Dakota. I guess they're afraid the Democrats will take North Dakota, and you heard testimony of how the Environmental Protection Agency was used for the last elections to hold up money to clean up California or hold it up to Detroit, not Detroit, New Jersey, so that the Democrats, who looked like they were ahead, wouldn't be able to say, we did this for you, we should be reelected. But evidently the Republicans need votes in North Dakota, and Edwin Meese called in his friend, the chairman of the Syn Fuel Corporation, and the money went quickly to them, and then that coward, that same day that he gives it to the project after being twisted by Edwin Meese, and they don't have to twist too hard, they're very good friends, that same day that Mr. Thompson resigned, he gave this money to the North Dakota project. That doesn't mean you're going to see anything for it, but that's what he did. And on the 28th of April, there was a Los Angeles Times article, Thompson's ties with Texas oil man question. See, the president of this corporation, and we'll do more of that in a little bit, Mr. Victor M. Thompson, was president of a bank in Oklahoma, the Tulsa, Oklahoma, and this $20 million, as I say, was gone, and he was being investigated by the Security Exchange Commission because of bad loans and because he didn't tell the board of directors about the money missing. And he lashed back at the news media as Washington as a jungle attacking him. And then by the 28th, they found out that he had pulled another typical Reagan administration trick by going to a man named Mr. Johnson, I don't know if he's related to LBJ in Texas, and saying, I want you to give me money to bail out my bank in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And in return, the Sinfuel Corporation would give him a few hundred million of a loan. You help me personally because the board of directors doesn't know the money's gone and I haven't told them to that effect. And then I'll get the government, that's us, the taxpayers, to give you money for your project. And now they're investigating that. The 29th, the next day, 29th of April, the New York Times, the LA Herald had a long story. Synthetic Fuels Corporation chief quits as the charges of impropriety widen. And that's when he attacked Washington as being, he said, I would never have come here if I knew you were so low. And what they were doing was finding out that he'd been on investigation for a long time and hadn't told the powers that be in Washington. And on the 30th of April, the Wall Street Journal said, U.S. Sinfuel program appears stalled as Congress moves to probe the ethics charges. And so they began to close in on Mr. Thompson. But then there were two more stories. Wall Street Journal, May the 1st, has a long story. Sinfuel's board had discussed their ex-president, he only resigned 3 or 4 days before, his potential conflict months before he quit, the conflict of asking Mr. Johnson in Texas to help bail him out, and in return, the federal government would give him $400 million for his fuel project that he couldn't put up himself. The federal government, the free enterprise system is gone, and you, the taxpayers, pay for this corporation. This is your corporation. You may not know it, but you are members of a corporation. And they gave it that title. And then the coup de grace, of course, was the articles that followed. Then May the 2nd up to May the 6th, the San Francisco Examiner and other newspapers, Sinfuel Prober's death called questionable. And the member from the investigative committee of the Sinfuel and Mr. Thompson was found dead in the bay outside of Baltimore. One story said, the San Francisco Chronicle said, Prober's death is unconnected to his work. He was just found dead with his pants off, floating in the water like Mr. Paisley. Remember John Paisley? In Baltimore, Thomas Doherty, 47 years old, head of the Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee for the House Energy and Commerce, former aide to William Proxmire, who was lashing away at this organization, and also a former aide to John Glenn. And another story, San Francisco Examiner the next day said the Prober's death is called questionable, and they referred to it as a mysterious death, like they are saying that David Kennedy now probably was murdered, and they're looking for the person who gave him the drugs. They said this was a mysterious death found floating in Baltimore Harbor. He was the key investigator in the probe that charged Victor Thompson, who earned $135,000 a year as a Sinfuel Fuel president, with violating the Sinfuel rules on standards of conduct. So you have the chief investigator who forced the head of the Sinfuel company to resign, the close buddy of Edwin Meese, who wants to be the attorney general, right at the height of the investigation, the week that the man has stepped down from his job, and the investigator is floating out in Baltimore Bay. If you don't think that it's time to get a little paranoid and join Mae Bressel on how these people get off when congressional committees begin to find the scandal in the dirt, just add it up again like the rock musicians or the actors or whatever you want, because it all adds up. Now, I'm going into the background of Edwin Meese and the power of Edward Noble, the chairman of the Sinfuel organization, the corporation, our corporation, because I want to give you the state of mind of this man. Some of the references, those of you who get the tapes, I have the dates of the articles on that sheet that accompanies this broadcast. And if you listen on the radio, you can send self-addressed stamped envelope and get the bibliography of the sources and look these up if it interests you. And I'll do a little bit more on those articles, but they are in the daily newspapers. I want to describe for you Mr. Edward Noble, the chairman of the Synthetic Fuel Organization that is so highly paid, that is so secretive, that is covered with controversies and buddyism and close to Meese and Reagan. I want you to know who runs this Synthetic Fuel Corporation so you get a little picture of the state of mind of people that have this tremendous amount of money. Before I begin that, I see it's just about 1 minute before the end of the half hour. So I'll take the break now.